We're in Hosea chapter 7 tonight, verses 1 to 16. God's need to judge due to the vileness of Israel's sin. The theme of divine judgment that is often found in the Word of God has been used by liberal theologians to criticize the Old Testament God as being unloving. I remember when I was in Bible college and seminary, many times I heard references to those in liberal theology saying that the God of the Old Testament is the God who is cruel and warlike, but the God of the New Testament is loving and gracious. That's just not true. In fact, if you get into the Old Testament, you find out that God there is very, very gracious. In fact, it's the God of the New Testament that we hear in Hebrews chapter 12 says, "For our God is a consuming fire." So God's personality hasn't changed one iota. He's immutable. That means he's not given to change. But the passage that we have in front of us actually shows us that understanding how vile were the sins God judged in the Old Testament reveals there was no choice for a morally upright God but to judge them, a truth that is revealed in Hosea chapter 7, 3 to 16. Let me just read the verses there, and then we'll look at them in depth. And I'm going to read tonight out of the New International Version because it's much, much clearer than the King James, although I'll do some preaching out of that. We're in Hosea chapter 7. Well, I'll just start at verse 1 and get that chapter in. Hosea chapter 7, verses 1 through 16. And like I said, we're getting this out of the New International Version. It's a lot like clear. It's more readable than what you would have in the King James. So here we go. Verse 1 of chapter 7. "Whenever I would heal Israel, the sins of Ephraim are exposed and the crimes of Samaria revealed. They practice deceit. Thieves break into houses, bandits rob in the streets. But they do not realize that I remember all their evil deeds. Their sins engulf them, they are always before me. They delight the king with their wickedness, the princes with their lies. They are all adulterers, burning like an oven, whose fire the baker need not stir from the kneading of the dough till it rises. On the day of the festival of our king, the princes become inflamed with wine, and he joins hands with the mockers. Their hearts are like an oven. They approach him with intrigue. Their passion smolders all the night, but in the morning it blazes like a flaming fire. All of them are hot as an oven. They devour their rulers. All their kings fall. But none of them calls on me. Ephraim," which is the predominant tribe of the northern kingdom of Israel, and so Ephraim mixes with the nations. Ephraim is a flat cake, not turned over. "Foreigners sap his strength, but he does not realize it. His hair is sprinkled with gray, but he does not notice. Israel's arrogance testifies against him, but despite all this, he does not return to the Lord as God or search for him. Ephraim is like a dove, easily deceived and senseless, now calling to Egypt, now turning to Assyria. When they go, I will throw my net over them. I will pull them down like birds of the air. When I hear them flocking together, I will catch them. Woe to them, because they have strayed from me. Destruction to them, because they have rebelled against me. I long to redeem them, but they speak lies against me. They do not cry out to me from their hearts, but wail upon their beds. They gather together for grain and new wine, but turn away from me. I trained them and strengthened them, but they plot evil against me. They do not turn to the Most High. They are like a faulty bow. Their leaders will fall by the sword because of their insolent words. For this they will be ridiculed in the land of Egypt." Okay, let's see what's happening here. God testified in Hosea chapter 7, 1 and 2, especially in the English Standard Version, that when he wanted to heal the nation Israel, its iniquity was exposed to be abundant, and the nation did not consider that God both remembered all its evil and that its deeds surrounded it and were conspicuously before his face. One of the things we learned about God is that he is very, very sensitive to sin and righteousness. And if there's sin in his people should never dare try to think that they can kind of cover it. It doesn't work. Sin is something that is right out in front of God. I heard one time of a little story of a little African child. I grew up in Nigeria. My parents are missionaries there. A little child was critiqued by one of the missionary ladies. "You've been drinking milk, and I told you not to drink the cow's milk that they had milk and everything." The little child said, "No, I didn't." "Oh, yes, you did." The child said, "No, I didn't. I know you did, honey. Come here. Come to the mirror. So she came to the mirror, and there was the mark of milk right across her lip like this. She'd forgotten to wipe her mouth clean. Gave it away. It's like thieves trying to steal and walking through the snow, and all the police have to do is find the trail. And that's exactly what it is with God. You can't hide. The sins are out there conspicuously in front of them. Well, then, to show how vile were Israel's sins, God used primarily the illustration of a baker's oven. You might have picked up on that as we were reading through the passage, but God often uses illustrations to clarify and to simplify the truth that he's trying to get across. By way of an analogy with a baker's oven, the Lord alluded to the great treachery that occurred against Israel's kings since they were repeatedly being toppled by lustful, conspiring princes. Likening the treachery of the princes who sought the throne to a baker's oven, the princes initially would secretly burn with treachery against the king like a dull fire in a baker's oven. See, you have a fire that's kind of basically going there all the time just to keep basically the oven warm. But when you want to cook it, you flame it into fire, especially in the morning. When I was in Africa, they would cook their bread in, it was like an earthen oven. It was a great big thing. And kind of like a pizza oven. Of course, there's heat all the way around, and so you can get some really nice thorough heating, and they would make a, kind of like a pita bread in there. Especially we had Lebanese people in Nigeria who would make absolutely scrumptious Lebanese pita bread, and they had sesame seeds on it, and we'd eat it with our macaroni and especially spaghetti and so forth. Really, really good stuff. It's great toasted as well, but that's how they would cook their breads. Then in the morning, when the fire is fed and the dull fire blazes into the full flame, the dangerous treachery would erupt to slay the king so that some other prince might come to power. See, the picture is all of these princes are trying to play king of the mountain. They all want to be king. So as soon as one of them arranges to upset the current king and kill him, and he gets on the throne, there's another plot up here to kill this guy so that the next guy can land up on the throne. And there's this great big toppling in constant conspiracy that is going on against the kings. And of course it keeps the nation in tremendous turmoil. But all the leaders are very self-centered. They're not thinking of the welfare of the people. These princes, for example, would celebrate with the king in a drunken party, verses 3 and 5, pretending to be his supporters while simultaneously planning to assassinate him. That's where in verse 3 they delight the king with their wickedness, the princes with their lies. In verse 5, on the day of the festival of our king, the princes become inflamed with wine. And he joins hands with the mockers. See, he was joining hands with the mockers. These are people who mock him because they were actually planning to kill him. You couldn't trust anybody in this situation. It's very easy to be paranoid then. So, like an oven whose smoldering fire of conspiracy was quickly inflamed into an overheated fire that destroys the loaf within, the king would scarcely be enthroned before he was slain. That's why you have the last part of verse 6. Their passion smolders all night. In the morning it blazes like a flame of fire. And then, verse 7, all of them are hot as an oven. They devour their rulers. They devour them just like an oven that's overheated and just burns the bread up. Yet regardless of all this instability, none of the rulers bothered to call on God for help. This is something that I found very critiquing here. All the kings fall, but none of them calls on me. There are many times in the past, or even when we run into a difficulty or a problem, I'll sit and I'll maybe for a couple of days kind of wonder, how are we going to solve this? And finally, after a couple of days, I think about praying about it. And I kind of kick myself. And, you know, you're up there behind the pulpit, constantly telling the poor people out there, you got to pray. Why don't you do it, Don? Save yourself a lot of headache. But anyway, I found that very critiquing when I read that. Well, instead, Ephraim, that's Israel's dominant tribe, and every time you see Ephraim in the passage, it refers to the northern kingdom of Israel. Ephraim launched a feudal foreign policy for stability. Like a cake that is mixed with foreign ingredients and put into the oven to bake, he still uses the analogy of an oven. Israel had turned to foreign alliances for stability, like a strange cake that was mixed with odd, awkward things in verse 8. Ephraim mixes with the nations. Ephraim is like a flat cake not turned over. Now, the flat cake not turned over is a lot like our hot cake, a pancake. Now, if you don't turn it over, it gets burned on one side and it's uncooked on the other side. You can't eat it. I don't know if we've ever tried to eat a half-cooked pancake, but it's a piece of work. On one side, it's too done, and the other side, it's too mushy. You've got to turn it over at just the right time. Well, that's what Ephraim was like. These foreigners with whom the nation had sought alliance soon discarded the nation like a cake that it was left unturned, and therefore it was half-baked. Such nations devoured its financial and military strength, while the nation Israel, like an aging man, was unaware of its waning power. Very interesting picture here in verse 9. Foreigners sap his strength, but he does not realize it. His hair is sprinkled with gray, but he doesn't take notice. So like in the, I guess human nature hasn't changed at all. As a man's hair begins to gray, he kind of ignores the first couple of hairs. And finally, after a while, he kind of says, well, but I look young for my age. And he just, you kind of go through this denial until eventually, you know, it's too late and you got to see the doctor and you're really bad off. But that's basically what the Lord is saying. Israel's like this. They're in sort of a denial. They don't recognize their great trauma because they've left the Lord. So Israel's proud refusal to acknowledge the Lord testified against her before the Lord. In verse 10, Israel's arrogance testifies against him. But despite all this, he doesn't return to the Lord as God or search for him. See, as troubles begin to mount, they're not even turning to God. Now, what complicates this problem is what they do next when they run into problems. In seeking the help of Egypt and Assyria like a silly, senseless dove, God, like a hunter fowler, would spread over the nation the net to bring it down in discipline. Verse 11, Ephraim's like a dove, easily deceived and senseless, now calling to Egypt, now turning to Assyria. What's so strange is that Egypt and Assyria are grand enemies. So Israel said, I know, we're going to play them off against the other. We're going to make treaties here with Egypt, and if Egypt looks like they're going to get too fresh with us, they're going to make a treaty with Assyria. Well, after a while, Egypt and Assyria saw the game that they were playing, so both of them trounced them and beat them up. So, I mean, it's like you have two superimposing bullies, and I'm your friend, now I'm your friend. After a while, the bullies get tired of this, and that's exactly what happened, and they just came in and took advantage of them. Ultimately, Israel had strayed from God to the extent that she rebelled against him. In verse 13, Israel's effort to seek the help of foreign nations was tantamount to rebelling against the Lord, replacing him with the idols of pagans that were around her. That's why he says in verse 13, woe to them, they've strayed from me. Destruction to them because they rebelled against me. I long to redeem them, but they speak lies against me. When people look to resources, in Israel's case it was looking to an alliance with Egypt or an alliance with Assyria, rather than looking to the Lord for their stability. It's a form of idolatry. Anytime we make something a replacement for God, it's idolatry. The money that we have in the checking account can become a form of idolatry. If we're looking to that for our stability and our security and our happiness instead of the Lord, it's a form of idolatry. I've had a real problem with chocolate donuts with chocolate frosting on top of them. That, in the past, has been kind of an idol for me because that's sort of a thing that I almost had to have, kind of a thing. And the Lord has been dealing with that over the years. Anything that we look to for satisfaction outside of the Lord is something that is wrong. Now, obviously, we have to eat. Obviously, we have to have money in order to operate. God knows that. And that's why Jesus said in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, your Heavenly Father knows that you have need of all these things, but seek ye first of the kingdom of God and His righteousness. All these things shall be added unto you. All the food you need, the clothing we need, and so forth. But anyway, Israel had sought foreign nations in a subtle form of idolatry. Then when God had withdrawn His agricultural blessings for that kind of rebellion, instead of repenting toward God, Israel had practiced idolatrous rituals to impress false agricultural gods like Baal to deliver the rain and the crops that they lacked. In verse 14, you actually have a reference to idolatrous practices in Baalism. They do not cry out to me from their harps, but wail upon their beds. That's what they would do in apparently Baal worship. And some of the readings, instead of saying they gathered together for grain, actually they slice themselves or they gash themselves, like with a sword or with knives. This is what the Baal prophets did when they were trying to get Baal to call fire down on the altar. Remember at Mount Carmel, at the competition with Elijah, they were gashing themselves. That was part of their ritual, their worship. So you can go with gather together, or you can go with gashing themselves. But either one of these, they're dealing with reaching out to Baal. Now this is the height of insubordination against God. Instead of looking to God, they're looking to Baal for help. They haven't even thought about going to God, or they've turned their back on the Lord Himself. And remember, Baal is the god of agricultural blessings in Baal worship. God's the one who's withdrawn the blessings, as per Deuteronomy chapter 28. God had warned them, if you go after these false gods, I'm going to stop the rain. I'm going to stop the crops from growing. But they're not paying attention to Deuteronomy 28. They're going to Baal worship. So though God had trained and strengthened Israel, she had devised evil against him. That's why you get in verse 15, I trained them. I strengthened them. But they plot evil against me. I think he's almost alluding to the princes. The princes in plotting evil against the kings are likened to the entire nation that is plotting evil against God. So, God has to judge. Accordingly, God promised that Israel's princes, who not only treacherously vied for the throne like a treacherous bow would fall by the sword, but who had turned on him as well, would become an object of derision among the Egyptians whose aid they had foolishly sought. That's why in verse 16, they don't turn to the Most High. They're like a faulty or a deceptive bow. Their leaders will fall by the sword because of their insolent words. For this they will be ridiculed in the land of Egypt. And that's when they go down there into captivity. The southern kingdom, some of the people in the southern kingdom ended up going into that particular area. So God needed, he had to punish Israel, as their sins were so vile and hurtful. Departing from the Lord, Israel's rulers lacked any accountability to God and turned self-centered and practiced treachery against their kings. That led to national instability and a loss of God's blessing, to which Israel went further into sin by making godless alliances with nations and seeking idols and not God for blessing. So there's a slippery slope here. Once they start going in something that's wrong, there's a withdrawal from blessing. So they get nervous, so they go further into evil trying to get a retrieval of blessing. That doesn't work, so they go even further into the evil. I've seen that happen in lives of people many times. They don't just stand still. It gets worse and worse. They get more and more deceived, and before you know it, they're way off the deep end. That's exactly what happened with the people. So we need to value God's discipline as the sin it addresses is so vile and hurtful. See, God's disciplining of these people was to drive a wedge between them and their sin. He had to be severe enough to do that so that they would get away from that and come back to him. God is by, I used this illustration in the sermon this morning, how that I had had an illustration in the sermon, and I'd withdrawn that illustration in the sermon notes that I'd had. I'd withdrawn the illustration on Wednesday, and then Thursday, and finally Thursday night, I figured out, you know, I was getting more and more restless. The Lord wanted me to put that illustration back, so I put the illustration back, and everything went nice. And the Lord used the pressure that he allowed there to demonstrate that he can lead me, and if I'm stepping out of line, he'll make it very abundantly clear. Believe it or not, I had been bothered for a number of weeks about something else, a decision I'd made, an action that I'd taken, and I was kind of second-guessing whether it was right or not, and was really bothered about it, prayed about it, but was really bothered. And finally, the Lord says, look, I'm tired of you being faithless about that, Don. So let me give you an illustration that if you're stepping out of line, this is how I work. Boom. So I thought, oh, yes, sir. Okay, got it. So the indication was, if you were out of line with that other thing, I would have made it crystal clear. So what I want you to do is to stop worrying about it. Put it behind you. It's all over. Just move on. Put a period and move on. And so the discipline of the Lord in reference to that illustration actually became something that was a blessing because it enabled me to relax over that other issue because of the way the Lord taught. God's disciplines are always wholesome. If he has to spank it, he's always looking to a positive product. He's never just, you know, losing his temper. He never does just for the sake of losing his temper. He's always instructive. He's always productive. And that's one of the wonderful things about our God. He loves us, but he's so wholesome, even his disciplines are desirable because of what they do and the peace that they bring within us. So we need to value the discipline. It's interesting, Psalm 19 actually talks about this. I didn't put this in the lesson notes that we have, but there's a verse in the Psalm 19 that talks about the tremendous value and desirableness of the discipline, the disciplines of God. Psalm chapter 19, verse 9. The fear of the Lord, or the respect for the Lord, is clean, enduring forever. And then the judgments of the Lord. Now, the judgments are verdicts. They can be negative punishments. They can also be alleviations. But the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold. Yes, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned. And in keeping them, there is great reward. Notice the blessings here. God's disciplines are more valuable than fine gold. It produces value in reference to income. Sweeter also than the honey in the honeycomb. They're also desirable because they produce a sweetness. There's a desirableness, a goodness in life. And then God also warns us by His disciplines. He keeps us out of deeper trouble. And if we keep the disciplines and the judgments of God, there's tremendous reward. So you really can't lose with the discipline of God. So what we need to do is, when we read about God's preparing to judge, instead of thinking, oh, trouble, 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 we ought to be thinking, great, what is God seeking to do? Because this is something I can learn as He judged Israel. I can learn from this for value in my own life to avoid worse trouble than I've gotten myself into. Okay, now we're off the air.